Yes, it's Radio Derb's election special. This is your pacifologically genial host, John Derbyshire, reporting on the major news events of the week, and some of the minor ones. Before commencing, though, I should apologise for the absence of a broadcast last week. This was due to a catastrophic concatenation of circumstances. After taping the October 27th broadcast, I flew over to the USA for a conjugal visit with Mrs. Derbyshire there on Long Island. I'm glad to say I found my lady in excellent health and good humour. The Derb estates were also in splendid condition, thanks to a decision by Mrs. D. You see, we had originally intended to lay off Miguel, the pool boy, when summer ended and our swimming pools were covered over. But my wife decided to keep Miguel on because of his rare expertise in pumping technology. She further promoted Miguel to general manager of the property, and she tells me he's done an excellent job of maintenance, reaming out all the pipes and keeping moving parts well lubricated. Well, if she's happy, I'm happy. Then Hurricane Sandy struck, with all the property destruction and loss of life that I'm sure you've read about. Radio Derb offers sincere condolences to those afflicted. Charitable listeners can help to relieve the distress via the Red Cross or local church groups, and we urge you to do so. The Derb estates were spared serious damage, but the local airports were closed all week, so I was unable to get back to my sound studio here in the balmy Aegean. Not only that, but I was unable to communicate with my assistants here. Naturally, without my firm guiding hand, things here on the island rather went to the dogs. The girls invited in some young men from the village, and a party spirit seems to have prevailed. I came back to find the studio littered with empty ouzo bottles, half-eaten souvlaki, and unidentifiable items of clothing. Disciplinary measures were called for. Mandy, Candy and Brandy have lost a week's beach volleyball privileges. The village is out of bounds and the Christmas party has been made conditional on good behaviour. The secret of leadership is to be just but firm, a lesson that I learned from our dear friend President Gurbanguly Berdimuhamedov of Turkmenistan. Long may he rule. Well, things are back to normal now, so let's take a look at the week's events. People talk about elections in terms of the presidency, but of course there's much more going on than that. There's a House of Representatives to be elected, one-third of the Senate, and governorships and state legislatures. The presidency is the symbolic big one, though, so let's take that first. Barack Obama won a second term, taking the popular vote by 51.2% and the Electoral College by 303 to 206, with some counting still to be done in both cases. In the post-election commentary, there has been more than the usual amount of talk about demographics. Blacks were, of course, solid for Obama at 93%. Hispanics voted 71% for Obama, Asians 73%. White Americans went 59% for Romney. When you look at the overall picture, however, we are all still fighting the Civil War. That is to say, the contest was mainly between two huge groups of white people who don't much like each other, with the coloured folk playing a marginal role. That's how it was in the war between the states, and that's how it still is today. In the state of Mississippi, for example, 89% of whites voted for Romney. 89%. In the state of Alabama, it was 84%. In the state of Maine, on the other hand, only 40% of whites voted for Romney. In Vermont, only 33%. Barack Obama wasn't re-elected by blacks, Hispanics or Asians, though they helped at the margins. He was re-elected by Yankees. And that works both positively and negatively. By northern whites turning out for Obama, and also by northern whites failing to turn out for Romney. In a much-discussed piece by Sean Trende on Real Clear Politics, Trende crunches the poll numbers to show that a large number of whites just went missing. Sample quote. Almost 7 million fewer whites voted in 2012 than in 2008. This is not readily explainable by demographic shifts either. Although whites are declining as a share of the voting age population, their raw numbers are not. End quote. 7 million. 7 million white voters who showed up in 2008 were too apathetic to do so this week. Trend's analysis seems to show that these missing whites are recession victims living away from the big cities and suburbs, enthusiastic neither about the guy whose party caused the recession, nor about the guy who, in 4 years, has failed to do much about it. Still, while the Republican Party may be, in a phrase coined by one of my colleagues at vdare.com, implicitly white, white Americans are not Republican, implicitly or otherwise. I just mentioned the low Romney votes in Maine and Vermont. Both those states are 94% white. Romney also lost Iowa, which is 89% white. Minnesota and Wisconsin, both 83% white. Ohio, 81% white. Pennsylvania, 79% white. Oregon, 78%. Michigan, 77%. And Rhode Island and Massachusetts, both 76% white. Romney lost them all. So, don't be blaming the coloured folk for this. Barack Obama, as I'm sure he'd be pleased to tell you, is the clear choice of some of the whitest parts of our country. How did he get that way? Next segment. So, how did Barack Obama win a second term? Well, there was some attraction to him and some repulsion from the other guy. Some pull and some push. The attraction to Obama was mostly purchased through the time-honoured method, fundamental to democracy, of shoveling public money to key constituencies. Bailing out automobile companies sure didn't hurt Obama in the eastern Midwest. Neither did bailing out banks in New York. Neither did giving stimulus money to the states to spend on their public sector unions. Where the attraction wasn't just purchased with cold cash, it was the residue from that thrill, you know, the one that went up Chris Matthews' leg, the thrill of having a black guy in the Oval Office. This wasn't as big a deal as in 2008, but it still counted, especially among young people. The 18 to 29 cohort voted 60% for Obama. And especially, judging by those numbers in the previous segment, in states where there aren't many blacks. The myth of the magic Negro has most power in places where nearly everybody is white. Repulsion from Romney, and I'm just talking now about whites, the only people who matter in this Civil War reenactment. Repulsion from Romney was mostly based on sex, class and religion. Romney won among men, 52%. Obama won among women, 55%. The marriage gap was even bigger than the sex gap. 62% of unmarried voters went for Obama, nearly two-thirds. Only 44% of married voters did. Some of those numbers key in with the racial split. White people are more married than non-whites. Some of it is the mood of mutual support and self-sufficiency that you get in marriage. You and me against the world, honey. If you're single, to whom do you look for support? Well, to your mum and dad, perhaps, but increasingly to the state, especially if you're a single woman and the state is personified by a capable-seeming and confident male. The class thing was the aspect most commented on beforehand. It's definitely class and not just wealth. It can hardly be wealth, as nowadays all politicians are rich. Barack Obama's rich. He hasn't always been rich, although he's never been poor. Joe Biden's stinking rich. Hillary Clinton is rich beyond the dreams of avarice. They're all rich. So it can't just be wealth. It's class. Mitt Romney was born rich, and then he got rich all over again, in a way remote from most ordinary people's understanding, by playing what looks to Joe Citizen like Monopoly-style board games with real companies. My personal guess is that something else is going on too, though. As social mobility declines and the middle class is more and more squeezed, I remind you that median income in the USA peaked in 1998 and has been falling ever since. As this happens, ever larger numbers of Americans dislike the rich, especially those born rich. When I was a kid, the story we were told was that in England, if a working man saw a toff drive by in an expensive car, he'd think to himself, "Damn those rich swine. Come the day, we'll be stringing them up from lampposts." In the USA, however, if a working man saw a toff drive by in an expensive car, he'd think to himself, "That could be me one day." That, we were told, was the difference in social attitudes between a class-based and a classless society. As America's class structure hardens into an endogamous caste system, that's less true than it used to be. I'm not sure that it even is true anymore. In this respect, as in others, the USA is drifting towards being just another left liberal class-based European-style social democracy. Here's one of the others. Religion. Religion was another factor repelling people from Romney, though a smaller one than sex and class. One of the striking things about the USA to a person who arrives here as an adult is the great hostility that irreligious Americans feel towards religious ones. If you settle in the irreligious Northeast, as I did, you hear plenty of sneering about Bible-thumping redneck hillbillies. Some of this is just snobbery of the good old urban-rural type that's been with us since ancient Greece. Sophisticated city slickers looking down on rustic folk. Some of it's the North-South divide, the Civil War again, the South being more religious than the North. And some of it is reasonable fear that religious scolds will cramp one's lifestyle, banning abortions, jailing homosexuals, enforcing school prayer on your kids, and so on. Well, the Republican Party is at the receiving end of this hostility. It's getting worse, too, as the USA becomes more secular. With Mitt Romney, the hostility was amplified by his being a Mormon. Not only secular liberals dislike Mormons, so do a lot of Christians. To be sure, Barack Obama puts up a show of being religious when he can remember to, but I doubt there is a single soul in America who believes Obama to be anything but a yuppie agnostic. So here we are, well on the way to being just another left liberal, class-ridden, European-style secular social democracy. It's there in the numbers. It's staring out at us from Tuesday's result. Bye-bye, American exceptionalism. We may be refighting the Civil War, with the election being an arm wrestle between two big blocks of non-Hispanic white voters, but this is less true now than in the past, and it will be even less true in the future. Already the number of non-Hispanic white kids in the nation's first grade classes is below 50%. The Census Bureau estimate of the date at which we'll be a minority of the population keeps shifting, but it's never later than 2050. A date at which my kids will be middle-aged, and I myself, actuarially, could still be alive, just barely. I pause here to note in passing, and with extreme irritation, the way in which this demographic transformation is usually discussed in the public media. I watched Sean Hannity discuss it in exactly these terms the other evening. The terms are that the browning of America is a natural phenomenon, like the tides or the expansion of the universe. It's just happening to us by some irresistible force of nature. Nothing we can do. That is baloney. This great demographic change driving whites into minority status is the result of particular government policies voted into law by our elected representatives. Mainly Ted Kennedy's 1965 Immigration Act. Under different laws, we'd have a different result. It isn't nature doing this to us. We did it to ourselves, with eyes wide open. And we've continued doing it to ourselves by bipartisan agreement, aided by public indifference and the suicidal niceness and generosity of Americans. On one side of that bipartisan agreement has been the Democratic Party, always keen to swell the low-paid and underclass segments of the population so that they have more voting booth fodder, more recruits to the public sector and healthcare unions, and more clients for the public sector to cater to. On the other side has been the Republican Party and its sponsors in agribusiness and chambers of commerce, always hungry for cheap labour, always striving to socialise their costs while privatising their profits. At any rate, the demographic transformation has happened. It's almost certainly too late to do anything about it. And notwithstanding that this election result, like all previous ones, and perhaps the next one or two, has been driven by differences among whites, notwithstanding that, Tuesday's result brought home the transformation to a great many people who up to this week had been refusing to notice it, or waving it away with Pollyanna talk about Ellis Island and the melting pot. As Peter Brimelow pointed out nearly 20 years ago in his book Alien Nation, this demographic transformation cannot possibly be good for the Republican Party, which is, as I said, basically a white folks' party. Some of the gloomier souls in the Conservative blogosphere are already suggesting that the GOP is doomed. That George W. Bush was the last Republican president. The Republican Millard Fillmore, as one wag said, referring to the last president from the old Whig Party. And that Romney Ryan was the last straight white male ticket, and so on. Some even gloomier ones. I refer you, for example, to Larry Oster's blog, View from the Right, have gone even further, saying that Tuesday's election is the end of the USA. Shelby Foote said that before the Civil War, it was customary to say, the United States are. And then that after the Civil War, that changed to, the United States is. Well, there's a bunch of people out there, some of them friends of mine, telling you that we've now moved into a third phase. The United States was. What should we make of all this? Is it curtains for the Republican Party? Are we headed for something like the Whig supremacy, which lasted for most of the 18th century in Britain? Will the Democrats become our equivalent of Mexico's Institutional Revolutionary Party, which held power for 71 years? Could it be that the USA itself, as a coherent nation, is heading into the sunset? Permit me to venture some speculations. What about the future, then? Does the Republican Party have a future? As I have been saying, there is no unity among white Americans. The old splits of education, class, sex, religion, city, country, and of course North-South still divide whites. And that is the basis of most of our politics. The Republican Party is white, sure enough, but whites are not Republican. This will presumably be less and less the case as whites head for minority status. At some point, the fact of impending minority status will sink in, and whites will begin to sink their differences and circle the wagons. At some point, the Lee Kuan Yew principle will take over. I've quoted it before, and I'll quote it again, because it's very quotable in this context. Quote from Lee Kuan Yew, who was the Prime Minister of Singapore for 30 years, and the power behind the curtain for a further 20 in that very successful city-state. Quote, in multiracial societies, you don't vote in accordance with your economic interests and social interests. You vote in accordance with race and religion. End quote. What then will be the fate of the Republican Party? The Republicans themselves seem unable to discuss this at any level above the moronic. The usual thing you hear is that the GOP has to reach out to minorities, especially Hispanics, by handing out a few million sets of citizenship papers to illegals, and by putting Marco Rubio on the 2016 ticket. This is, as I said, moronic. Not mormonic. Been there, done that. Moronic. In the first place, Marco Rubio's a white guy of Cuban ancestry. An outlier among Hispanics. From a group that Mexicans, Puerto Ricans, Dominicans and Guatemalans don't much care for. In the second place, non-white, non-Asian minorities in the USA underperform in education and employment, and they have for generations. You don't need to have a metaphysical theory about why this is so. It's just so. It has been for decades, in defiance of every kind of remedial action, and there's no evidence anyone can do anything about it. For example, we now have a good database on Hispanics covering the fourth and fifth generations. The statistics are terrible. High school dropout rates, test scores, unmarried pregnancies, crime, every kind of social dysfunction. Hispanics, in the generality, are an underperforming group that depends on money transfers from whites and Asians via government. Why would this group ever, in any numbers, vote for a small government white party? And you can, of course, write that out all over again in boldface, large type and italics for blacks. In the third place, given the previous point, where on earth is the sense in expanding this never-going-to-vote-Republican demographic by awarding citizenship to a further 3 or 4 million of them? What's the logic here? We got into this pickle because of uncontrolled immigration. How do we get out of it? I know. Let's try more uncontrolled immigration. As Basil Fawlty would say, brilliant. Or, as a different Englishman, Daily Telegraph columnist Ed West, headlined his column this week, quote, "Pundits tell the Republican Party, the only way you can win is by importing more Democrat voters." End quote. Did someone say stupid party? This is beyond stupid. In the fourth place, Republicans have poisoned their credibility in this zone by being complicit in the phenomenon they are now pretending to be vexed by, as I described before. The hunger for cheap labour on the part of Republican donor groups has been a big driver of our country's demographic transformation. Why should we listen to anything Republicans have to say about this? For 50 years they've been part of the problem. Why should we now believe they're willing to be part of the solution? And in the fifth place, this talk about reaching out to minorities and diversifying the ticket just insults white people, the very group that Republicans should be trying to rally. OK, say in 2050 our numbers fall below half the population. That's still a mighty lot of people. Are you telling me that for the next 38 years, this huge bloc, the founding stock of modern America, should not be allowed to see themselves represented on a presidential ticket? Where's the equity in that? But, I hear you say, if the GOP is to be the white folks' party, and if white folks are destined to be a minority even within the possible lifetime of a reactionary old fogey like Derbyshire, then the GOP will be a minority party, forever excluded from power, won't it? That depends on how things shake out over the next 40 years. Yes, in a nation made up entirely of ethnic minorities, any ethnically based party will of course be a minority party. To get power under the present constitutional order, supposing that continues to exist, two or more minorities will have to unite under one party. But, A, I refer you to Lee Kuan Yew's observation, quoted earlier, that in a multi-ethnic state, politics inevitably comes down to an ethnic shoving match. And B, this logic will apply to the Democratic Party too, only in the opposite direction. Let me just elaborate on B there. The only thing binding the Democratic Party together right now is hatred of traditional white America. As traditional white America fades in power and importance, The Democrats, deprived of that binding force, may come unglued. By mid-century, our politics may consist of three, four or more minority parties in floating alliance with each other. It's plausible, for example, although I'll allow I may be influenced by personal bias here, it's plausible that whites and East Asians could go into coalition with each other, or that successful white Hispanics like Rubio might be at odds with underperforming black and Amerindian Hispanics, or that blacks and Hispanics may turn enemies, as they already are in jails and schoolyards all across the nation. So, I take this chatter about the death of the Republican Party with a grain of salt. However, I take the other chatter, the chatter about the Republican Party ceasing to be a white party, I take that with a whole truckload of salt. No, make that a 100-wagon locomotive full of salt. Come to think of it, let's make it a container ship. As I said, there's more to the election than just the presidential fight. Here are some election odds and ends. The House of Representatives definitely stays Republican, though probably with a reduced majority. We don't have all the numbers in at the time of going to tape. The Senate definitely stays Democratic, with an increased majority. Also, an increased gayness quotient, with openly lesbian Tammy Baldwin winning a Senate seat in Wisconsin. Ms. Baldwin was formerly a congressperson. Openly homosexual state lawmaker Mark Pocan was chosen too, according to the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, in phrasing that I can't help but think very slightly unfortunate in the context. He was chosen to fill her open seat. Of the 11 state governorships up for election, the GOP has picked up one, for a total of 30 governorships, and may pick up another one in Montana. Not just the balance of power in Congress is the same, so is the rhetoric. With a tremendous fiscal crisis looming, John Boehner,
"You feel better if you cry,"
declares that government spending must be cut, but taxes must not be raised. While Harry Reid declares that government spending must not be cut, but taxes must be raised. Hey ho. My best guess is that the polls will kick the can down the road a year or two somehow, while stealthily turning up the heat on the inflation burner. That is the only way to square this fiscal circle. In state ballot initiatives, the homosexualist revolution continues to march on. The states of Maine and Maryland voted to allow same-sex marriage. That makes them the 7th and 8th states where a married couple can be frank and earnest. Although in point of fact, the way it actually comes out in practice, they are much more often Francine and Ernestine. They are, though, the first states to make the decision through a popular vote. The states of Colorado and Washington voted to legalize marijuana, although since it's still an illegal drug in federal law, there's going to be some knotty litigation up ahead before you can legally light a spliff in Aspen or Spokane. A couple of tidbits from the congressional voting. In Illinois' 2nd District, Jesse Jackson Jr., who has represented the district since 1995, was re-elected with a thumping 64% of the vote. This is noteworthy because Representative Jackson, A, did no campaigning whatsoever, in fact, did not meet with a single constituent and has not been seen in public since early June on account of having been hospitalised in various clinics for treatment of bipolar disorder. And B is in the throes of negotiating a plea deal with federal investigators looking into felony-level misuse of congressional funds. Oh, Representative Jackson is also the subject of an investigation by the House Ethics Committee. We congratulate him on his re-election. Finally, we said goodbye to Thaddeus McCotter, representative from Michigan's 11th District, whose lugubrious charm featured briefly in the GOP primary contests last year. McCotter had actually resigned from Congress back in July when it was discovered that he'd faked the petitions required to get him on the ballot. It was later discovered that he'd faked the petitions in at least two of his previous five elections. Thad was replaced as representative for Michigan's 11th by Kerry Bentivoglio, who is described by the Detroit Free Press as, quote, a former teacher, veteran, Tea Party member, part-time Santa Claus and reindeer rancher, end quote. Well, now he's in Congress, he can be a full-time Santa Claus, can't he? And now, our brief miscellany of closing items. Imprimis. Nikki Nikolaides, proprietor of this island's only fast food outlet, famous throughout the Aegean for its goat burgers, drew the following news story to my attention the other day. It concerns a gentleman named Islam Bhatti of Rajasthan, India. Based on that first name, I guess we don't need to spend a whole lot of time speculating about Mr. Bhatti's religious affiliation. Well, Mr. Bhatti has a goat, and he's looking to sell it for $200,000. This goat, you see, has a brown and white coat. And the brown bits, if you squinch up your eyes and stare hard, look like the word Allah written in Arabic script. Devout Muslims sacrifice a goat or a sheep at their festivals, you see, and there's a festival coming up. So far, Mr. Bhatti has only been offered $50,000, but he's holding out for the target price. I asked Nicky if he'd be in the market for that goat. He said, nah, too skinny. Then he went on stirring a pot of fabric dye. Item Head Start is always worth a bit of mockery. As I noted in my galaxy-wide bestseller, We Are Doomed, Head Start, it's a preschool program for low-income children, Head Start is a huge totem among liberals. Quote from myself, quote, their faces light up with virtuous certitude as they utter it. Head Start. And the effect of the charm they seem to imagine is to silence their opponent. You can't possibly be against Head Start. End of quote from myself. Well, you should be against it. In its 47 years of operation, 47 years, there has never been any conclusive evidence that Head Start does any good at all. When Stefan and Abigail Thernstrom wrote their 2004 book, No Excuses, Closing the Racial Gap in Learning, they reviewed the evidence up to 2003, by which point $60 billion had been spent on the programme over 38 years. The Thernstroms found no proven benefits from the programme. Cost of the programme this fiscal year, $8 billion. Well, here's this week's news item. Back in 1998, Congress mandated that HHS do a nationwide evaluation of the program and report the results to Congress. There was a schedule for them doing this. In particular, a key document called the Third Grade Follow-Up Study, the most comprehensive ever on the long-term effects of Head Start, was supposed to be delivered by September last year. We know that the data for this study was all collected by early 2008, and the data analysis had been completed by 2010. Yet, Congress still hasn't gotten the report. Last month, Senator Tom Coburn of Oklahoma and Representative John Klein of Minnesota wrote to Kathleen Sebelius asking for the report and an explanation for the delay. 4 years since the data was collected, 2 years since the analysis was completed, over a year since the scheduled delivery date. Still no report. I wonder why. Perhaps the HHS printer ran out of ink. Item, finally, some news from my church, which is, of course, the Church of England. The church has a new boss this week, which is to say a new Archbishop of Canterbury. We don't officially know who it is as we go to tape here, but it seems well nigh certain to be Justin Welby, currently Bishop of Durham. The Right Reverend was formerly an oil company executive, so he should at any rate be pretty deft at the anointing business. Sensationally, Bishop Welby is neither a woman, nor black, nor homosexual, nor a Muslim. He's an actual Christian, married with 5 kids. His father was a bootlegger in the USA during Prohibition. Then he returned to England and married a private secretary of Winston Churchill's, and they begat the bishop. The new archbishop, if that's who he is, comes with a wee bit of scandal attached, although not really his fault. Britain has legalised betting on anything at all, and the punters have been betting on who the new archbishop would be. Clergymen especially, it seems. They've been using insider knowledge to place some big bets, to the degree that one of the big bookmaker firms suspended all betting on the new archbishop after the odds on Justin Welby dropped in the space of a few hours from 7-4 to an odds on 1-2. The Lord moves in a mysterious way, his wonders to perform. But it's a bit less mysterious if you have a friend in the bishop's palace who can pass you a trainer's tip. That's all for this week, boys and girls. And with no offence whatsoever to listeners who are unsure on the boy-girl thing. I think I already gave offence to the differently oriented there somewhere, didn't I? Yes, I did. No need to over-egg the pudding. Passing from the ridiculous to the sublime, I note in all seriousness that this weekend includes what in my childhood we called Armistice Day, November 11th, and what here in my new country I know as Veterans Day. A very heartfelt thanks to all who have served our country and our civilization under shot and shell in land, sea and air. In England, Armistice Day honoured both surviving veterans and those who fell in battle. In American terms, it was both Veterans Day and Memorial Day. On the closest school day to the 11th, we'd all gather in the school hall and sing this lovely hymn, O Valiant Hearts. Thank you for listening. More from Radio Derb next week.